And I actually think that this series on compassion is probably as good a place as any to look for resources in when we feel threatened or we feel upset, when people are making us feel less than. And I posted something this week by a colleague of mine who is also a minister, and their words to their congregations and to you that I pass on, or if you're having trouble, if all of this is affecting you, if it's making you feel triggered or traumatized in some way, it's okay to turn it off. And that the most important thing they wrote in their post is to have compassion for yourself and to take care of yourself. So I think that's as good a place as any to look. And maybe the stories and the exploration of self-compassion that we do today will be revealing or at least provide resources in that regard. So there's a Zen story that I have heard, that I first heard in a sermon by Reverend Rob Hardies, who is the minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in D.C. And as I read it again in a book of Chinese Zen stories. It tells of a meditation student who, while meditating in his room, believed he saw a spider descending, bless you, descending from the ceiling. And he, each day he would sit, and each day this horrible spider would return. And it looked like it was menacing. It looked like it was sharpening its claws and like getting ready to attack him. And he just thought, maybe it'll go away. And it just kept coming. And so he finally went to the master and said, you know, this is happening. I'm having this spider descend from the ceiling and it's sharpening its claws and it's going to get me. So I have a plan. My plan is next time I sit in meditation, I'm going to bring a knife. And when I see the spider, I will kill it. And the teacher said, oh, wow, that's really intense that that's happening. How about a different suggestion? How about you bring with you a paintbrush and have some ink ready, and when you see the spider descend, just reach out and mark a circle on it. And the student thought that was stupid, but decided to do it anyway. And so he's sitting in meditation, and sure enough, here comes the spider, and it's sharpening its claws, and he reaches out with the pen, and he marks a circle on the belly of the spider. And after he's done meditating, he goes to the teacher and says, okay, well, I did it, you know, so now what? And the master reaches up on his own shirt and pulls up his own shirt, and there's an ink circle there. And then he reaches over to the student and says, you know, take a look. And the student looks, and on his own belly there is an ink circle also. Sometimes what we fear is actually something that's inside of ourselves. And sometimes the thing that we feel like we most need to kill or most need to attack is actually something going on, and it's something that we feel aggressive towards in ourself. And that can be really dangerous. It's a concept of projection in psychology, where the things that we hate are, it's like too uncomfortable, it's too dangerous to see that things that we don't like within ourselves, and so we project them out on to another person. And you can often learn a lot about a person, about what they're struggling with, by what they most are attacking in someone else. And how we treat ourselves matters. And of course, the reverse is also true. So compassion for yourself, which is what we're talking about today, compassion for yourself feeds into compassion toward the rest of the world. Buddhist teachings would tend to start with compassion and meditation by extending that to the self and then moving out into the world. Some of you who are more experienced meditators will know about this. And as with a lot of things, Western psychological research is catching up with Buddhist teaching that's been going on for a long time and finding that, in fact, yes, feelings of compassion toward the self are correlated with feelings of good feelings and care towards other people. How we treat ourselves and how we regard ourselves matters. And so this, as we follow along, this is the second in a 10-part sermon series inspired by Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. This is the second sermon, and we really are digging deeper into the path that she lays out for a compassionate life, and it begins with self-compassion. The first two steps, which we talked about last month, are sort of learning about what compassion is and then taking them a moment to look around at the world and to realize that there's a lot in our world that deserves compassion. Compassion has to do with both having a feeling of care for other people and then being moved by that care to do something. And Armstrong begins her chapter, if you haven't got the book, I urge you to do it. Armstrong begins her chapter on self-compassion by talking about a story of the late Rabbi Albert Friedlander, who worked in interfaith dialogue and civil rights in the United States and in the United Kingdom after growing up in Nazi Germany. And Armstrong tells this story. She says that Friedlander really taught her about the golden rule, to love your neighbor as yourself, and that it doesn't just mean love your neighbor, and that it means love yourself too. He said, if you cannot love yourself, you cannot love other people. And she relates his story of growing up in Nazi Germany and surrounded by anti-Semitic propaganda telling him who he was and that he was bad and that he was all of these horrible things. And she tells it like this. One night, when he was about eight years old, he deliberately lay awake and made a list of all his good qualities. He told himself firmly that he was not what the Nazis said, that he had talents and special gifts of heart and mind, which he enumerated to himself one by one. Finally, he vowed that if he survived, he would use those qualities to build a better world. And she concludes, Albert was one of the kindest people I have ever met. He was almost pathologically gentle and must have brought help and counsel to thousands, but he always said that he could have done no good at all unless he had learned at that terrible moment of history to love himself. What we believe about ourselves matters. A lot of people that I know did not grow up learning how to practice compassion for themselves for various reasons, and I count myself among this company. For various reasons, we grow up with a really robust inner critic and with the practice of critiquing our own mistakes. And often there are those among us whose sense of self has gotten entangled with depending on being right, being competent, always doing the right thing. Robust inner critic and inner perfectionist. And it's I sort of wonder, like, where did that all come from? And I know some of it comes maybe from religious upbringings. I know my mother, for example, grew up in an ultra-conservative Lutheran upbringing in working-class Milwaukee. And not all Lutherans have this type of fire and brimstone religion that they do, but she did, and they taught her. She grew up learning that she was personally horrible and personally sinful and personally could be expected to be smited by God at any minute. And that feeds a robust inner sense of self-judgment. I don't think that can be the whole story, though, because I didn't grow up in that kind of milieu, and I still grew up with self-dissatisfaction. So I think some of it's just the wider culture. Some of it's advertising and capitalism generally. Advertising relies on first showing us that there's something wrong and then showing us how the product that we buy can fix that problem. And so in a world full of advertising, we're in a world full of criticism and teaching us to look at ourselves with judgment. Or consumerism and capitalism, which feeds a story that human worth is what a person can produce, can manufacture, or can consume and can buy. And that, you know, if you're not able to produce or manufacture or consume or buy enough things, then there's a sense of shame and judgment about that. Armstrong talks about that and says, in our target-driven capitalist Western societies, we are more inclined to castigate ourselves for our shortcomings and become inordinately cast down by any failure to achieve our objectives and potential. And then, of course, how we treat ourselves matters. And so if we're more inclined to castigate ourselves, then we're more inclined to castigate others. And we get in this shame and judgment cycle that just adds to suffering. And so Armstrong puts this step of self-compassion really early in the book, because the idea is that in order to live a compassionate life, that we have to work also on compassion for ourselves. So we'll unpack this idea of self-compassion and what it is and what it isn't. Researcher Kristen Neff is a great resource on this, a secular resource. Some of us will have heard of her before in a previous sermon that Sharon gave about cultivating compassion. And she explains that self-compassion involves three things. Or there are three aspects. So there's self-kindness instead of self-judgment, seeing our common humanity instead of seeing ourselves as isolated, and practicing mindfulness rather than over-identification with our negative thoughts and feelings. So that's a lot. So let's start with the idea of self-kindness. The idea is to remember that just as we would treat someone we love with kindness when they fall short, we can treat ourselves with that same kindness. It's interesting. It's actually in a society where sort of compassion for the self doesn't come naturally, it's learning self-compassion through our sense of compassion for other people. And as Neff puts it, self-compassion entails being warm and understanding toward ourselves when we suffer, fail, or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring our pain or flagellating ourselves with self-criticism. So the idea is that, just as someone you deeply love, if they make a mistake or are imperfect and they're coming to tell you about it, you might not go, yeah, that's terrible, you are a terrible person. So if you hear that voice in yourself going, I did this and I did this and it's bad, you wouldn't talk back to yourself with that voice. I was talking to my dad a while ago, and he was saying, yeah, and I just didn't do this and I didn't do that. And I'm just terrible with these details. And I said, don't talk to my dad like that. Self-kindness. And then common humanity is this idea that we're not the only one who has ever suffered or hurt someone or failed. It's something that happens to all of us. It's part of the human experience. So as we heard in our meditation, you are not unique. A lot of times we think about ourselves as unique, and we use that as a way to look at our things that are really good about ourselves, and that's valuable, and you are not unique in having failings. You have failings, but so does everyone else. You also have talents, and like every other being on the planet, you deserve compassion and joy and friendship. And it can be easy in self-pity or self-judgment to sort of say things like, oh, I'm just the worst, or like, I have the worst luck. Everything is so challenging, and it's common. The idea is to imagine that and remember that we all have common humanity. We have a visit from our preschool class today, so we'll just do not be alarmed. Hello.
You're so short.
Are you alarmed by how short they are? Yeah. Okay. Well, it'll be okay. So that's self-kindness, common humanity, and then mindfulness. And the idea is that we can cultivate self-compassion. In order to do it, we need to be aware of what's going on in the moment. Not avoiding or numbing pain, but observing it. Somehow taking this idea of like observing the thoughts and the feelings helps to take a step back, helps to put a little bit of daylight between our sense of self-worth and the mistakes that we've made or the pain that we're experiencing in the moment. Kristen Neff also has some, so those are some things about what self-compassion is. She also has some helpful definitions about what it isn't. Specifically, it isn't self-pity. It isn't just sitting and going, oh, poor me, I'm so the worst. She says, self-pity tends to emphasize egocentric feelings of separation from others and exaggerate the extent of personal suffering. I'm the worst person in the world, or I am just the person that the world is out to get. I feel so sorry for myself. So it's not quite self-pity's. This is another place where we're learning to distinguish between pity and compassion. There's a warmth in the self-compassion that is there isn't in pity. It also isn't, so it's not self-pity. It also isn't self-indulgence. She says many people are afraid to practice self-compassion because they're afraid they would let themselves get away with anything. I'm so stressed out today, so to be kind to myself, I'll just watch TV all day and eat a quart of ice cream. And that isn't, she said self-compassion is looking at, yourself as a whole person and doing, what is wanting, knowing that you want to do what is good for yourself. Not necessarily indulging. And then she also really has a beef with the idea of self-esteem. The idea, she says, that the idea of trying to build up self-esteem has this tendency to build up the ways in which we are all special, the ways in which we are all talented, the ways in which we are all great. And she finds that that's not super correlated with health and mental wellness. So self-compassion is not false self-esteem or pretending that we're perfect or, only looking at our good qualities. It's facing honestly the reality that we are all imperfect and then having compassion for ourselves anyway. Armstrong in her book likes to talk about our lizard brain that makes us do things that are, that makes us want to fight or be selfish and aggressive. And she says, there's no point in beating yourself up about that. We just all have it. But we can also try to learn to be compassionate and selfless along with that. And that it's not productive or possible to try to pretend that that lizard brain doesn't exist. And so self-compassion is about helping us deal honestly with mistakes rather than trying to live up to some impossible ideal all the time. It doesn't mean that we don't try to do better, but it turns out that trying to sort of self-criticize your way into doing better doesn't work. Kristen Neff points to one danger of that, which is that it might be hard to face difficult truths about yourself because you're so afraid of hating yourself if you face them, right? So it's too scary to imagine that there's a spider around. And so you might, instead of lashing out at it, you might just pretend it's not there. Self-compassion invites us to notice what is real, what is there. And to remember that everyone makes mistakes. And that's how we learn. And so self-compassion imagines that we would treat ourselves with the same warmth, the same care that we would treat a good friend. I think I said as I began that you can learn a lot about a person by what they are talking about in other people. And there's a sort of preacher correlation with this, which is you can learn a lot about what the preacher is thinking about and wrestling with by what they are preaching about. We say sometimes that we preach the word we need to hear. And so I am working on being more self-compassionate. It does not come easy for me. But I actually really have liked this idea of pretending that I'm my own best friend, or looking with tenderness on the scared or the mistake-making part of myself. We are all human. We all make mistakes. And there's something about self-compassion that's actually very universalist. The historic Christian universalist believed that everyone would go to heaven, that Christ saved everyone eventually, no matter what sins or mistakes that people had made. And self-compassion, I think, is like that. It has to do with that idea that no matter what we've done or felt or experienced, we are all worthy of compassion, and that we can understand that in our own being. No matter what our lizard brain prompts us to do or to feel or to react, we're still worthy of compassion and kindness from ourselves. We can look clearly at the spider rising up out of our worst or most troubling selves and be able to observe it clearly and to treat it with compassion. And in time, I think self-compassion can lead to self-forgiveness. It's a good time of year to talk about forgiveness. Our Jewish brothers and sisters and siblings have just gone through High Holy Days, have gone through a practice of asking for forgiveness and offering forgiveness, a time to atone for what's been done wrong and to resolve to begin again. And here at Chalice, we often take this opportunity at this time of year to remember that tradition that some of us come out of, and for those of the rest of us to learn from it and to reflect on the ways that we have not lived up to our highest ideals and to begin to work on forgiveness. And so in that spirit, we're going to do a litany of atonement that was written by a Unitarian Universalist minister. And it may not be that you are able to really feel like you've changed everything and that forgiveness has come now that we've done this ritual. But I encourage you to sort of maybe hold those words lightly and to know that think of it as a reminder. Think of it as a returning to that practice. So I'll invite our song leader up, and we're going to do, we'll go through, there's a sung response to it. We'll remain seated, and we'll go through that response once, and then Carol and I will alternate our leading you through the words of this litany. And then we'll practice singing together. It's in your hymnal. It's number 1037.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference.
We forgive ourselves. We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For each time we have struck out in anger without just cause.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For each time that our greed has blinded us to the needs of others.
We forgive ourselves and each other.
For the selfishness that set us apart and alone.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
I lost my place.
Are you right?
Right there.
Right there.
For falling short of the admonitions of the Spirit.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For losing sight of our unity.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
And may we, as we move out of this gathering today, may we know that we are worthy of compassion. May we truly forgive ourselves. And learn to forgive others. May it be so.